chemical reaction, and you're the main attraction. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
How does love begin? How can two strangers come to the conclusion that it would not only be pleasant to share their lives, but that they must share their lives? Physical attraction, jealousy, infidelity, mother-infant bonding, all the behaviors that so often leave us befuddled are now being teased out of the fog of mystery thanks to today's social neuroscience. Larry Young, one of the world's leading experts in the field, and journalist Brian Alexander explain how those findings apply to us. They do so in their new book, The Chemistry Between Us, Love, Sex, and the Science of Attraction. It's a great pleasure to welcome Larry Young and Brian Alexander to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it, gentlemen.
Thank you, Jeff.
So, Larry, let us begin with you of how we came to the scientific place where we are now of knowing what we know. How groundbreaking is this?
Well, it all started probably around 15 years ago when we started studying a little rodent called a prairie vole, which is has a family structure very similar to our own in the sense that they mate and they form a bond throughout their lifetime. The male and female work together to raise their offspring. And we began studying these animals to try to understand what is the biochemistry underneath that process. And we've made a number of really groundbreaking discoveries in animals, suggesting that molecules like oxytocin and dopamine and vasopressin are all acting in the brain to create that bond, that lifelong bond that occurs between these animals. And in the last few years, there's been a remarkable number of studies in humans to suggest that very similar processes may be going on in our own brains as well.
Is there something specific about the prairie vole that would have you examine them?
Oh, yes. So most mammals, 97% of mammals, do not form any kind of bond between the mating partners at all. Most species, the male and female come together and mate, and then they're off on their separate ways. The male is off to find a new partner, a new female, and the female is left on her own to raise her babies. So the prairie vole is really one of those 3% of mammals where they come together, they mate, but then with that mating, chemical changes occur in the brain so that they now form an attachment to each other, and they prefer to spend their time with their partner over any other prairie vole. So to me, I believe that although this is not love, prairie voles are definitely not in love, it's a kind of a bond that I believe shares a lot of neurochemistry, the basic fundamental neurobiology that underlies human love.
Larry Young is the director of the Center for Translational Social Neuroscience, the William Timmy Professor of Psychiatry at Emory University School of Medicine, and chief of the Division of Behavioral Neuroscience and Psychiatric Disorders at York's National Primate Research Center. You're the scientist. Brian is the journalist, an award-winning journalist and author of several books. So, Brian, journalistically, what do you find fascinating about this story?
Well, whenever I write about a scientific subject, it's usually in the context of what it means for our society or our culture. And when Larry and I first started talking about doing a book, I was blown away by the social implications of these molecules. I mean, at one level, it's very tiny molecules acting on cells in our brains. But if you extend that out to the entire society and our entire culture, it has a massive impact, and that's what really fascinated me.
Larry, when you look at that of that impact, how quickly does that happen? Is there love at first sight, or can it? It has to develop in some cases.
Well, in the case of voles, we can actually induce this bond within just a few hours by injecting this single molecule into the brain. Now, I can't promise you that the same time frame is happening in humans, or even all of the same molecules are involved, but there are certain similarities. So from a scientific perspective, I really can't answer the question of whether there is love at first sight. Probably there is lust at first sight, which is a feeling, an emotion that often precedes love.
But what is it that brings us together in the sense of that where that attraction, that initial click. So upon the first meeting, you wish there to be a second.
That probably involves more of a sexual attraction, which is not necessarily love. We often mistake that for love. But that is probably, you know, a combination of the rush of our steroid hormones acting in the brain, as well as dopamine. Dopamine is a molecule that's released when we ride a roller coaster, when we do something that gives us a rush, or even if you take cocaine or heroin, it's something that gives us that pleasure and reward. And that's the molecule that initially sort of drives that sort of lust, the desire, the wanting, the liking of that other person. And it's only after some time with that, and then you have the other molecules like oxytocin adding to that cocktail, that chemical cocktail, do you begin to grow a real attachment.
And that's what we do in the book, is we walk readers through this process of how our brains are formed in a sexual matter. In other words, what sort of sexual preferences we have, how we express our gender, who we're going to be attracted to, the process of lust and reward, and then eventually leading to love.
There is a title, the second chapter in the book is The Chemistry of Desire. What do we know about desire? Larry?
Well, we know, again, rooting my answer in the animal research, we can take a rat or a small rodent like that, and if we take away their steroid hormones, estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, they have no sexual desire. And we can simply give a single injection of one of these steroids back to the animals, and they will go into what we call heat, estrus. If anyone has had a cat that's gone into estrus, they know what kind of behavioral changes happen when that cat goes into heat. Now, humans, of course, we know that the changes in human female behavior, for example, is much less than what you see in a cat. But what we reveal in the book is that there are studies in humans that suggest that, like some of our animals, there are changes in sexual desire over the ovarian cycle, for example, so that when females are ovulating, they may have a different kind of preference towards a different kind of male. So there does seem to be some hormonal correlates to human sexual behavior as well.
You write in the book, Brian, there isn't a good explanation for why men might pick the wrong woman. We mean to say there is an accurate explanation, just not a very appealing one. We're easy.
Yes, that's true. One of the things that we talk about, say, male circulating testosterone and male desire is we never really know when we're going to run across a mate that appeals to us. So we always have to be somewhat ready, and it doesn't take a whole lot for us to get ready. And going back to what Larry was saying, one of the things we do is talk about a famous study regarding strippers, and that tips and stripper earnings actually go up when the strippers are at or near ovulation. In other words, the men open their wallets and are much more generous when they see a stripper who's just about to ovulate. Now, neither the dancer nor the man knows or is conscious of this effect, but something is clearly affecting the reward processes and the desire processes in both the man and the woman.
Did you learn that from the voles?
No, we did not learn that from the voles.
Yeah, okay. when you look at the fact that this brain chemistry, that it can often... It sort of reoccurs. I mean, you make the point that if the brain chemistry between a woman with a new baby and one with a new boyfriend, that there isn't much difference in the actual chemistry there.
Right. So this is one of the, I think, really the most fascinating points of the book, is that the molecules that are involved in the bonding between the partners, the male and the female, it turns out that those are the same molecules that are involved in the bonding of the mother to the baby. And again, these are initially were studies done in animals that show that when a mother gives birth, before she gives birth, usually in animals they don't like babies. They try to avoid them. But once they give birth, they are incredibly attracted to babies and their own babies. And that is due to this molecule called oxytocin, which is released during labor, and it's released when the mother nurses her baby. And that's the molecule that's responsible for focusing her attention on that baby. And in animals, all mammals, the mothers bond with their babies and are motivated to take care of their babies. And what we think is that in species where they develop monogamy, that same system that's involved in mother-infant bonding in females is now directed towards the male. So when they mate and there's vaginocervical stimulation, you have that same kind of oxytocin release as the mother has when she is giving birth. And that, so the same neurochemistry is used in both cases.
When it comes to what we all, maybe not we all, but many of us strive for, which is a solid relationship and a loving relationship with our partner, with this information, what can we do with it? How much control do we have in the sense that we can use this information to our advantage to make sure that we have stronger relationships?
Well, we know a little bit about what causes oxytocin to be released, for example. Hugs, kisses, looking into the eyes of others, any kind of intimate relationship stimulates oxytocin release, as well as sexual activity. So there are a number of things that we can do in our life with our partners to sort of stimulate this chemistry. And really, we don't need to do it to stimulate the chemistry. It makes perfect sense that these things would work, but it's still acting through this chemistry. And my wife always says, you know, when I talk about oxytocin and maybe I can try to stimulate her oxytocin release, you know, she sort of blows me off and says, why don't you try flowers? And so it's not all about chemistry. But I think probably even flowers are stimulating oxytocin and dopamine release in some ways.
So there is a practical application to the chemistry then, Brian?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that we talk about in the book and that we try to communicate is that in some sense, the idea of choice is it's less than what we often think it is. We think we sort of choose each other in a very sort of deliberate way. And what the book reveals is that choice is a little less of a choice than we think, and that love itself changes. I think there's enormous anxiety out there about that couples have after a period of time. For example, if you know time has gone by, the relationship is a little older, they're not having sex as often as they used to be, and they see this as a very bad thing. And one of the things we talk about in the book is, this is utterly natural. It happens in any of the rare animal species that that mate and have a bond. They have much less sex than they used to. And I know this from writing a sex advice column for NBC that people really worry about this. And one of the things we say in the book is, hey, this happens to everybody, and there's really almost nothing you can do about it. You know, you can try to buy lingerie and so on, and that works, and flowers work. That's all fine, but it's inevitable that this initial sort of thrill period is going to go away. And you should stop worrying about that because it happens to everybody.
Another thing that's interesting in the book, Larry, is you talk about cheating and how some people are genetically more likely to cheat.
That's right, but I want to be careful and not to say that genes determine whether someone is going to cheat. But in fact, what we know is that at least from animals, for example, we know that certain genes that we inherit or certain versions of genes make the animals more likely to go off and have extramarital affairs. And in humans, I think there's pretty good evidence that genes are affecting this kind of behavior. But certainly not determining it. So there's a delicate interplay between our environment and our society, our culture, and also the genes that we inherit. So the genes can sort of tip us in one direction, but we still are responsible for our own behavior, and we still make those decisions. But our neurochemistry sort of color the way we make those decisions.
We refer to it as a bias toward one kind of behavior or another. In other words, it doesn't force you to behave in one way or another. As Larry says, it sort of tips your brain in one direction or another. And it, as it turns out, that may have a very valuable effect on the human gene pool. And we explain why in the book, why some level of infidelity might actually be a good thing for human beings.
The name of the book is The Chemistry Between Us. It's published by Current. Larry Young and Brian Alexander, I want to thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Great pleasure. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.